Hello, and welcome to Crit Club. I almost led with an extremely copyrighted song from House of Mouse that rhymes with Canadian tights. Canadian tights. But Crit Club attorneys advised against it. This, as always, is a podcast where four friends sit down with a movie from the Criterion Channel that none of them have ever seen before. And then, in a death of a thousand cuts, they talk about it. My name is
Al, one cut.
My name is Wizard Chris, and I'm joined in this exciting endeavor by my co-host Angela.
Well, hello.
Peter.
Hello.
And Corey.
Hello.
This week we are settling in with a classic fantasy film, 1940's The Thief of Baghdad, an Arabian Nights-inspired, very lavish Technicolor production from Alexander Korda, featuring no less than three directors. This film stars the heavily mascaraed John Justin as King Ahmed, the very brown-faced Conrad Veidt as Jafar. We're going to go with Jafar. They Jaffer in the movie, but...
it's impossible to say it is not
Jafar. The gravitas of Jafar. Yeah. June Dupres plays the unnamed princess, and teen sensation Sabu as Abu, the thief. I chose this
unnamed
movie...
Unnamed princess.
Sorry. No, it's... I chose this movie as part of my my New Year's resolution, my quest to kind of dig back into the early days of cinema and find some interesting and exciting stuff there. Not a silver screen classic, Technicolor production, but still. I had heard of this film, and I'm very aware of its influence on Disney's Aladdin, as I'm sure we all are now after seeing it. And that's oddly one of my favorite Disney films. Robin Williams really kills it, so I wanted to see... kind of that seed of an idea, you know? The film won a slew of Oscars for technical achievements, including Best Cinematography, Best Art Direction, Best Special Effects, a lush technical spectacle for 1940 or any decade. The Thief of Baghdad was also marked by the first use of chroma key compositing, like blue screen.
Yeah, that was cool.
Which was very cool. They use it frequently in the movie, and you know, it was pretty cool. Is it a fantasy film that stands the test of time? Is it a hopelessly dated, tacky, and overlong production? Did Disney do it better? I have my own answers and thoughts about this, but as always, I want to hear from my co-host first. I would love to start with Angela. What'd you think of The Thief of Baghdad?
Angela, if you don't mind, if I could just jump in real fast. It is in the Criterion Collection. And it's number 431. Sorry, Angela, go ahead.
Is everyone ready now? Is everyone prepared?
I'm prepared.
Before I open my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. It was all right. You know, it was like Disney, like you said, it was like Disney before Disney. So it was kind of cool to sort of see like a movie that I don't even like Disney. I lived in California for 30 years and never once went to Disneyland, which I feel like is an achievement. However, as a fantasy film and maybe one of like really the biggest like special effects films in cinema and color, it's kind of a fun thing to watch and sort of understand that when this was released, it like blew people's minds, right? And so it made me wonder, like, how are people going to respond to our big special effects movies in the future? Like, are they going to look at Star Wars with the same kind of like, oh, isn't that quaint feeling that I had for A Thief of Baghdad? It was a fun little ride. I had a good time. I thought it was a sweet piece of cinematic history, but it didn't like take my breath away or anything like that. I mean, because it's, you asked, you know, is it this cheesy, tacky thing or is this a huge technical achievement? I say it's both. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And what I really wish is that I could talk to someone who was a kid and saw this movie in the theater, because I would love to hear what their experience, they're probably dead right now, what their experience would have been seeing this in the cinema. And I feel like I've read a book about someone who like kept going back to see The Thief of Baghdad as a kid because they were just so blown away by it. And I can relate to that because, I mean, how many different movies did I watch over and over again as a child? Like Neverending Story or... Back to the Future or The Goonies. I feel like Thief of Baghdad is even far more fantastical, but maybe just as enchanting to kids of that generation as those movies are to ours. But that's pretty much it on my part.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And Frida, when we were watching it together, mentioned, you know, she watched a number of movies like this that reminded her of this. She hadn't watched this, but she watched like Clash of the Titans and stuff mm-hmm. like yeah, all the time yeah. when she was a kid. And she was like, if I saw this as a kid, I'd be watching it all the time. So mm-hmm. yeah.
That's cool. Angela, to your point, I think people in the future will look at movies and wonder why studios paid human actors when you could just conjure simulacra or something like that. Peter, what did you think of Thief of Baghdad?
I think I, well, I mean, it is a colonialist through and through movie in all of those ways. I think also it charmed me a lot. I think I'm coming in a little more favorable than Angela did. Like I understand exactly Angela's point on it. I think I was very charmed and delighted by this production. I think I'm just a huge sucker for scope.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I think is like a way to like talk and think about this and my like sort of, I don't even know what I was expecting with this movie. I was like, oh, what is this? The Thief of Baghdad. I guess I missed the whole idea that, oh, it's the, you know, precursor to Aladdin and all this sorts of, it's, you know, 1001 Arabian Nights and all this mm-hmm. sorts of like subtextual mythology that's already baked in. I guess I didn't even know what it was. And once, you know, Technicolor splashed up on the screen and these matte paintings elongating the fucking terrain, and I was just really captivated and enchanted and very delighted by everything that they wanted to throw on screen, like for all of its problematic stuff, which there was a lot in up to and including No Name Princess. It still felt like there was like a whimsy that they were bringing to another culture rather than maybe an other ring. I don't know, but we can talk all about that sort of thing. But I think it was interesting to see when I was not as delighted as other times in watching this, because boy, you could tell that more than three people, or at least three people, directed this movie. Like, you can tell that at least three people yeah. wrote it. You can tell that, like, reading through the Wikipedia page, like, the production moved all over the world, you know, at 1939 or whenever they were
producing it. At one point it was going to be a musical.
Like, when the war was coming.
Like, it was going to be, and you could tell that too. There's, like, yeah. three songs yeah. that hang in there for the whole movie, but the whole thing was going to be a musical at some point.
And like at the beginning, I was like, oh, this is like this amazing fantasy epic. And then I was like, oh, but isn't this only like 140 or like an hour and 40 minutes? Like, that seems incredible to they're going to squeeze that in. But still, at times, I was like, this movie feels longer than mm-hmm. an hour and 40 minutes. Like,
I didn't realize, you know, it was that short. Yeah,
I thought it was quite
yeah,
a longer.
I mean, like, yeah, there are times and things that go through the script where it's like, do we need to like have the search through the giant spider for the eye? Like, why don't you just wish to go to the like there were clunky elements.
But yes.
Yeah, I don't want to get too granular about my complaints about it, but I think it sums it up by saying you can tell that this was produced, directed, and written by a committee. Yeah. But all the same, I found it really amazing, and that such a beautiful movie exists, and that I hadn't seen it, and that I was able to just witness the spectacle of it, because I'm a sucker for scope. And more often than not, this movie really worked on me, and I'm delighted to have watched it and seen it. So that's where I'm landing.
Amazing. Corey?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of similarly with you, Peter. I think that I went in with this with very low expectations, and I was continually, each scene, I was like, man, this must have taken so much effort. Yeah. Like, yes. They had to, like, paper mache a giant foot and then, like, stick pieces of hair into the side of a giant ear. Yeah. And, like, this is so much work going on in this. This isn't, like, I was also, like, afraid that it was going to be, like, super racist. And yeah. I guess I was pleasantly surprised that it was, like, only a little racist. In that, like, you know, yeah, it is taking this. It definitely felt like the whole, like, my culture is not a costume type, you know, vibes on this, where they were definitely putting on costumes and making this, you know, fantasy about, you know, these other cultures. But it didn't feel like they were being, like, mean about it. They were just being sort of like, you know, casually 1930s.
Yeah, casually, like a racist school play. It's like, well, these are the costumes mm-hmm. that people in Arabian Nights wear, right? Like,
right, yeah. and so, you know, I was watching this and I'm like, you know, this isn't like my kind of movie. I don't, you know, this isn't like, you know, gonna I think, maybe get scored as high as it probably, you know, deserves, for especially being the sort of technical feat that it was at the time. But, you know, the whole time watching it, I'm just like, you know, really in awe of kind of all the effort that, you know, they put into it. And yeah, maybe it could have used some like polish, meld some elements together a little better. But overall, I'm really glad that I watched this, like you said, this little piece of, you know, cinematic history.
Wizard, where did you land? Yeah. Did the Thief of Baghdad steal your heart? Or do you wish you would have flown away on that magic carpet?
That was a good one. I had a lot of fun with this movie. It is all the things that we've kind of discussed. Like, there are some real cringe moments around a lot of things, I guess. There are some benignly racist 1940s tropes in this film. But it's such a, you know, it's such a spectacle. We've used that so many times. It was such a spectacle. I see like all of these other movies that I love dearly, like, present in this movie. Like, I see Indiana Jones in here. I see, I see like any like spectacular film, like creature features of the 1950s. Like, they brought in the giant spider in the third act, or like the second and a half act or whatever. And yeah, it's just so many like inventive ways of like creating space, creating like the illusion of this like much, much bigger film. And this is a big film that spreads out and does all these tricks to like really, you know, it does world building well. And I think that's really cool. Yeah, I had a great time watching it. I was only horrified maybe once or twice during the film, at least in terms of how racist it is. It is exactly that. It is a really interesting piece of history, and there is like a seed there that goes way beyond Aladdin, goes to like other like spectacular films, other special effects driven films. And so I think that makes this movie really interesting. It's not like my favorite movie, and maybe if I had been a kid seeing it, I would feel differently about it. But it's like, you know, it was a magical picture. Real cool. So many tricks. Yeah.
I'm going to think about this movie for a long time. I'm definitely going to watch it again at some point, just because of the visuals, just because of how they presented. There are just like landscapes and scenes. Sorry if you're done but just like the sort of landscapes and scenes of, you know, not only Baghdad, but like I think about when they go to Basra and like just walking along, and there's just that painting of the sort of pinkish city, the pastel city sort of on this hillside. Like, it's just, you're just there, and it's just very striking. And for a split second, at least, I was just transported and just like, man, what a thing to see. What a thing to witness.
And there's so...
Do we kind of want to go through the story a little bit?
Yeah, let's do that. So our story begins in media res, which is always exciting. So you're probably wondering why I got here. our blind friend, we meet John Justin, who plays Ahmad, who does not know that he is king of Baghdad. He has been stricken blind by a curse of some kind. He is picked up off the street by an agent of, the former king's vizier Jafar, played by silent film actor and general scary guy Conrad Veidt, and he tells very scary,
it's a scary name.
And he tells his story, how he used to be the king of Baghdad, and he fell in love with a girl and met a thief who was transformed into a dog. This girl is the unnamed princess who... It's an underwritten part. Let's say that.
Because I didn't know until I was watching some other ancillary material after this that this was based off of the 1944 film. This was basically a remake of the silent film, Thief of Baghdad. Angela, have you ever seen that one? You probably have the most silent film watching of all of us. I don't know if you'd ever seen that one. It was.
I bet you $5 I did watch it because it sounds very familiar. However, those were my crazy college days, and mm-hmm. maybe some of these films that I watched didn't necessarily retain in my memory. I far more remember watching like Metropolis, sure. And Nosferatu and stuff like that, but Thief of Baghdad does not come up in the memories.
Yeah, Douglas Fairbanks, it was his next one after Robin Hood. So it was like when they were like, oh, mm-hmm. ladies will watch these movies. Let's give them some red meat. But mm-hmm. I bring it up because the one thing that seemed to be the difference, the biggest difference between the 24 film and this 1940 film is that they split that main character. Douglas Fairbanks in the 24 film was both, was Abu the thief and, you know, that sort of raises to this. And they turned it into, you know, Sabu the thief. And the whitest name possible, John, of John Justin,
the heavily mascaraed John Justin. Where, yeah, yeah, not a convincing King of Baghdad necessarily. I thought he was great. I don't know. He did a great job being a totally bland protagonist.
But this was the part that, like, that this is one of the first sort of red flags that I found in, like, the pacing and the story of it, because he told mm-hmm. rather than it showed, like, how Jafar tricked him mm-hmm. out of, or, like, arrested him in this way that I was like, but
yeah,
how did that,
I felt like
was,
I was like, did I miss a right, scene or something, yes,
right,
like that?
Like,
yeah.
No one was like, oh, no, this is the king. I'm a guard. I see the king every day. I'm like, never mind. He's an evil vizier. Yeah. These are the abilities that evil viziers have. They steal thrones like that. Easy.
Well, he's an insurmountable
villain. He's an evil wizard.
Just like the Shout.
Which is also about an evil wizard.
Wow. Are we getting to the point now where the Shout has to be mentioned in every episode? Like, I feel
that.
Like you
I
tried
did that
so
to get
hard
a response
on that.
For you all. No, I did that to get a... I mean, I'm correct. I mean, what I said is accurate.
You're not wrong.
But I also said it to get a response. Sorry.
But so the plot is, you know, it's a classic, like, fairy tale plot. Like, the film itself is kind of built around these special effects set pieces that the film is very proud of. We have our grumpy genie. We have our giant spider lair. What else? Just all the flying around.
The like doofy ass king.
Yeah, the right. Toys, like all of the toys, the flying horse, the
yeah,
lined up flying
yeah.
horse.
Who sells his daughter for a horse? Like,
yeah.
For a flying horse.
That's a flying horse.
I mean,
horse.
It's a flying I did, horse. Actually, I think the flying horse was my favorite part.
Oh, mm-hmm. Nice.
I thought that was
I really loved the Clockwork Assassin. I was that like, too. This is a compelling performance. Mm. Like,
I went back and rewatched that because I was like going down the Wikipedia hole, and that was played by a woman who ended up being a very notable figure in the yoga community,
okay.
like teaching yoga until she was like 101 years old and died in like 2020, still teaching a regular class in New York.
Hey, good
yoga.
For her.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a life. Now that's a life yes. worth living, people.
That's a life worth living.
I, as long as we're complimenting the cast members, I'll also say that is one really smart dog.
Oh my God.
Very impressed
dog
with
was
that
great.
Dog.
Great dog.
Oh, I see. You were impressed with the acting of
yes,
the dog.
Act, yeah.
I think it was impressive
and like,
as well.
Do very good tricks yeah. and all that. So it was very smart.
Yeah, yeah. Pulled out that fake coin. That is very impressive.
Oh, I also really enjoyed that garden where all the women were living,
mm-hmm.
And the
mm-hmm.
tree
bed
and
swing and stuff. And...
Oh yeah.
And I loved that because that's okay. So that's sort of what next happens, right? Is that like Ahmed, whatever. Escapes
Ahmed,
and then it's yeah. Basra where he meets the princess, and I was very enchanted by that scene of like her thinking the genie in the pond.
The genie scene,
I thought that was very sweet and like really lovely,
very cute.
In an old Hollywood way.
Is it wrong that this is the first time I've ever heard the city of Basra named in a way that wasn't tied into the Iraqi war?
No.
I feel bad about that. I should be I'm sure there are plenty of people living in Basra now and that they care very much about their city, and I should know more about that.
Now you know that they have toy obsessed sultans, yes, and unnamed princesses. Mm. All your education needs to come from movies. Okay. It's all there.
Awesome.
I just have in my notes here that like we're going through this scene and I'm just like, my God, these two are moving fast. And yeah. I mean, I guess this is what happens in these movies. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
the whole... It's 1940. We got no time. We got no time to waste.
Love at first sight. Just got to move on.
That was, yeah. Oh, it's just like a hallmark of this time that I feel like, yeah, you got to either let it, either jump on board or, you know, or leave it behind. It's, it's very jarring and frustrating at times. I remember the Grand Hotel. Greta Garbo falls in love with Lionel.
Oh,
Barrymore,
my God, yes.
In like just 5 seconds, and it's very strange.
Well, so I don't know if I should talk about this in my what else you're watching or not, but this movie sent us down a classic, not classic, but like 90s Disney rabbit hole for a little while, because we're like, well, we got to go watch Aladdin now, and then
I mean,
might as well watch Little Mermaid. Might as well watch
Song of the South.
But like that happens in all those movies too, where it's like, you know, these immediate attractions and like, you know, mm-hmm, super falling in love. Also, I'll talk about it later, but Beauty and the Beast is pure trash. Terrible.
I've never watched it. That's one Disney movie I never watched. I did like Little Mermaid, though.
Little Mermaid and Aladdin still thumbs up, but yeah.
I think that if the protagonists, if the king and the princess don't fall in love, then we accidentally lapse into like a snappy 40s like comedy of manners kind of thing. And we got no time for that because we got genies.
It's funny because like in modern movies, definitely with romances, a lot of times with, you know, the buddy person who you're eventually going to like team up together and like solve the problem of the movie with, like there's always the scene where they don't like each other at first. And then you have to have them like repel from each other, and then through the course of the, you know, plot, they go through things together, and then they like come together and they love and fall in love and whatever, like, and so, but no, not with this. It's just
there's too much to go through.
No time for that. There's too much to go through.
Hey baby, you horny? I'm horny. Let's go.
Well, I mean, I am curious though about like back in the day before, like say pre-1900s. I wonder if people actually got together far faster than they do at this point.
Certainly.
Because
absolutely,
they're, you know, you can't have sex before marriage. And so I'm assuming that, like, if you're starting to feel a little randy, that, like, if, you know, especially if you don't want to, like, end up with a baby before, you know, 8 months after your wedding, like, that the motivation to get married is pretty high. And you have all these guys who are, like, pent up with sexual energy that they can't express, and so there's a huge amount of motivation to seal this deal quickly. And
yeah, I feel like our boy John Justin was expressing his John Justin fucks, I'll say that. He wears eyeliner, he fucks, he never asks this woman her name.
I did think I felt like I had met him at the goth club before.
And so what? Oh, go ahead, please.
No, I found him such a strange, like obviously he, like this guy playing a character named Ahmed is insanity, but I found him like strangely, I found him like a strangely compelling leading man in this movie for some reason. I have no idea. I think it's the eyeliner because it makes him look like he stepped out of like a 90s like Danny Boyle film, or like a movie about the hard side of boys
like
school
wave
or something like that.
Or something.
Yeah, like a new wave musician. But you were going to say something, Peter.
Oh, no, I was just like, so he meets, they fall in love. It's all very quick and great. I was also a little curious, but again, you don't have a movie without this, of like why Jafar chose to blind him and turn Abu into a dog rather than just like have them killed. Mm-hmm. But again, you don't have a movie if.
He was perfectly willing to cut their heads off at one point in the movie, and then he later changes his mind. He's like, no, but he does it to be skeevy with Princess.
Well, isn't it also just like way more torture to like be of the world but not able to see it, and to maybe know that your beloved is out there but with some horrible magician? Ooh, that's the worst.
Villainy. So oof, good. What a villain.
Oh, what a strange movie. I expected like the flashback to be the whole of the movie, and at the very end, like it catches up, but it catches up pretty quickly with that. And what a strangely paced movie.
I kind of liked that. I like that we like begin with the blind man telling the story of how he used to be king of Baghdad, and then the movie catches up, and now we are like carried along on the story, which was really, I don't know. It's exuberant. Yeah. It's an exuberant film. It's got a lot of moxie, let's say. So the king sees the princess. He's immediately smitten with her, but he also gets his throne usurped. He escapes from prison with the help of Abu, played by Sabu, who did a great job. Sabu does a really, like, it's like a very physical role, and he plays like a very, like, he does a great job with that. There are times in this movie where, like, any time that that Abu, the character, is a dog, I'm like, y'all remember this used to be a human being, right? And they they speak to Sabu the dog and Sabu the man in the same way, which I didn't love.
Yep. John Justin gets blinded, but
you become a dog.
Yep.
You know.
Not great.
I mean, is it not great? I mean, isn't there room for there to be like, couldn't you become a dog and be pretty damn happy about it? Like, pee anywhere you want.
I hope I come back
speaking
as a well-loved dog.
Right. people, like, if you're charming enough with a high enough charisma, people just give you food. Mm-hmm. And if you're snuggly, like, you can get pets, really. You just look
at
someone.
It's a good looking dog. I would foster that dog.
You know, let's just not just assume that being turned into a dog was like a total awful thing. I want, you know, it would be kind of funny to actually see, like, don't turn me back into a human. What are you, you know, being this dog is the best.
We were talking about this before, we were talking about Yorgos Lanthimos before the show. Being turned into a dog is not always a great thing. Sometimes it really sucks. Shout out to The Lobster, everybody. Get in on that one. Good one.
I will say, like, that Sabu, I think, does a great job. I mean, I think he was, I forget how old he was.
17.
Like 17. Yeah. Okay, yeah. And, I mean, he really plays that role really well. He's very magnetic, very charismatic.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Agreed.
Carries a lot of the scenes. And, yeah, he's fun. He's a lot
I mean,
of
he
to watch.
Brings an energy. If there was, like, somebody else there, I mean, like, I think that's, like, I think that's why I think about this movie and the decision to make like this character into two characters when I don't give a shit about Ahmed, John Justin. Like, I just really want, like, I mean, Abu brought like an energy, and it was just filled, even with, you know, scenes that I thought were maybe like ill-placed or not great for like a plot. I was watching it because I thought he had an energy.
Yeah,
he was bringing it, and he brought his all, and I thought it was extremely watchable.
And they, like, after that, it's just a series of adventures. There's a quest for a magic gem. There's
because
we meet a genie,
who also does a great job. Really love that guy.
With a very specific accent, like that. I was like,
it's like a New York genie.
It was
genie.
Kind of.
Is it?
No,
is,
it was kind of.
Is it just still a little crazy that this film is actually so diverse? Like, there are actual brown people in this movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
I kind of appreciate that for all the eyeliner and, you know, cultural identities as costumes. At least there are two people who are not necessarily white folk in it.
Yeah, like your
and that's
secondary
I was
protagonist
about all...
is a person of color. That's I don't know what life is like in the 40s, but not great.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought about, like, all the crowd scenes. I mean, like, what a you know, spectrum of people for, like, these enormous crowd scenes that, again, I don't think were, at least in my perception, but what do I know, like, handled inelegantly. I don't know. But that genie, but there's this accent that I, like, keep picking up on that's, like, half mid-Atlantic, that's half, like, because I read that guy was from Chicago. But there's like specific words of like foist, like
no.
Like,
he's
there's
from,
this like
he's from Cairo, which is for those of us Peter that are from the area where we're from. It's where the Ohio River starts.
Oh,
not even Cairo, Egypt.
Oh,
like, I'm such a dumbass. Yeah. Like,
but your foist wish. There's like this weird 1940s, 1950s mid-Atlantic thing of foist. there was this flesh that I don't know that he had that I thought was very charming. But he, again, another, like, he brought it. That dude brought it. And he was like, look at my nails and look at my foot. And now I'm going to kill you and stomp on you.
Looks like he also has some gross sex crimes that we don't have to get into.
No.
Oh, cool.
Genie, why? No. Lord.
But anyway, this is the part of the movie when I was like really impressed with just, I don't know, the entire making of the foot and the entire like making of the side of his head and all that
stuff. Yeah, these like practical effects to complement these very early visual effects that are like, again, like still pretty cool. Like I was still impressed, like even though this technology has been invented for this movie, just kind of watching like the staging of these things, watching where those compromises were made with like the fake foot or the fake genie head to like blend this new like blue screen technology with regular movie making. And this is the 40s. Like I was really impressed by the scale and the effort that went into crafting these scenes.
Except they couldn't get a bald cap to look good.
But. Yeah.
No, not at all. Hey, I've said it 1,000 times and I'll say it 1,000 times more. In the year of our Lord 2024, we are no further along in wig technology. And it is devastating to me. But for did anyone else watch any of the extra features Criterion Collection of this or Criterion Channel of this? Because Angela, I think that's as close as you're going to get about talking to somebody who saw it as a child. The one that I watched was a featurette on special effects, which featured a long interview by none other than Ray Harryhausen, the guy who did stop motion of Golden Voyage of Sinbad and all stuff. And it was really great. It's a long featurette. It's like 40 minutes of them sort of going through a lot of these big set pieces and showing sort of behind the scenes pictures of sort of what was happening and also sort of explaining it in very technical ways. It's great. It's a great featurette. If you all like this, or if listeners, you enjoyed this and wanted to learn more about special effects, I thought that was a really cool featurette.
Very cool. No, didn't he only recently die?
Maybe.
I don't know. Like the last, certainly in the last like a decade or like maybe 5 or 6 years, I think so. Mm. So Abu becomes master of a genie. He cleverly avoids using his wishes just to kind of get the genie to take him from place to place. And part of that, if he wants to find his friend, does he call him friend or does he call him master?
He calls him master the whole time, like the genie generally.
I was thinking about Abu. He says, I want to find my friend, right? And the genie leads him to a temple. He says, well, if you want to find your friend, you need to steal a magic gem from the forehead of an idol. And this was my favorite scene in the movie.
It was. Okay, great, go for it. Talk me through it.
So cool. It's just like pure like comic book adventure. I loved the matte painting of the goddess, or like the giant Buddha, I guess. And just the image of Sabu climbing this giant statue and the sort of way that they put that together. It looks fake as hell to modern audiences, absolutely. And it for me captured that sense of wonder that you get from like a really like well executed like special effect or scene. Or like I just when I was watching that scene and then he's climbing the spider web to get to the top of the statue, and then the friggin' giant spider comes down and they're like long shots of him like fighting the spider. He looks super tiny. The close up shots of him whacking a sword at a puppet. All of these techniques to create fantasy and spectacle in this way that I'm sure like is very rare. It just like, again, that wonder of like a well executed special effect in film. I felt like a rush of that. I was like, oh wow, well done, you guys. That was very effective. Blood spraying from the puppet, all the things, the octopus at the bottom.
Yes, spiders at the top, octopus at the bottom.
What are you gonna do?
Yeah, I was a fan of it. The flight to get to the temple took longer than it should have.
Absolutely.
And then I didn't understand exactly what he was going after. Mm-hmm. The one thing that did bug me, because Abu did it twice, was put the sharp end of the sword in his mouth, like facing towards his mouth. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my God, yes.
I was like, Abu, no! Other way.
First day as an adventurer.
But no, it was definitely very charming, but that was this part where I was like, wait, why are we here? And then at the end, he just wished to be by his friend. I was like, dude, you could have did that before you needed to fly to the end of the world on a genie's ear. Yeah, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Again, wouldn't have a movie.
Yeah.
You got to do all these exciting things. So we steal the gem. The genie bails. Abu breaks the gem. And this is the part of the movie. We could have cut most of this. We could have most of the...
I still don't know what was going on
most
here.
Of the, like, the trans-dimensional city inside the gem, like the lost city of Kandor, just chilling out. He meets like a wizard king who gives him a crossbow that will kill the unjust.
Yeah, I loved that. I actually really enjoyed that part. Because of how weird it was, because of its weirdness. Because that was like, wait, what are y'all doing? I've never read any of 1001 Arabian Nights. I've always meant to. I've always wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Because that felt like it sprung from hundreds of years of like mythology, where the actual sort of like plot is very much lost and anything could just happen anywhere. But I just loved how like, not random seeming that was, but like, oh, just pure of heart dudes being pure of heart, handing out crossbows wherever they want. But I also found it very charming of the, like, you can have everything you want except this rug, when it was very clearly, you know, just tempting a thief to be a thief. I thought that was kind of great. I really enjoyed that personally.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
For some reason, it reminded me of... Now, it has been a long time since I've seen this movie, so I could be misremembering this, but it reminded me of the gay agenda part of Brain Candy.
I just rewatched that movie. Really?
Like where they just kind of go off on this weird little tangent about, like... Please remind me, but it's like the whole world is being controlled by the gay agenda and all that stuff, and it has no bearing on the rest of the movie. Like, that's what this reminded me of.
I don't remember that at all.
Maybe it was from something else. Maybe it was a different movie.
Yeah, I mean, Scott Thompson's gay, and there's like
maybe
marching
down
the street.
Maybe it was Run, Ronnie, Run. It might have been Run, Ronnie, Run.
Oh, I haven't watched that in about it.
Okay.
Decades.
Again, I haven't seen this movie in a long time. And then he gets this little Deus Ex upholstery.
Whoa. It's magic carpet. Magic carpet is a critical piece of any Arabian Nights tale. We gotta get a magic carpet in this thing.
I feel like everybody would have been waiting for the magic carpet. Like, it's finally
Where's
the magic
carpet?
Carpet.
Where's the carpet?
Exactly, yeah.
You can have anything you want Arabian except Nights this carpet, it. Which is totally awesome. I'm going to tell you exactly what it does and how to start it. Good for him. So Abu flies back, and then there's a big battle. Abu shoots Jafar, which was great.
Shoots two people right in their third eye. I loved it.
Uh-huh.
You could shoot them anywhere, and twice. Once I was like, that's a choice, and twice, that's an intention. I loved it.
It's an enchanted
crossbow. I also thought the flying horse falling apart in a different
yes!
position.
Very cool. I laughed and clapped. I clapped.
Very cool. King becomes king. Princess becomes queen. Sabu becomes vizier. No, wait. No, he doesn't. He flies away on a magic
carpet. No, I loved it.
He doesn't
when he started talking
school.
About like going to school
yeah.
and like just the look on his face and all that stuff. I'm like, ugh.
But I didn't. But that's also one of those like that felt very like, again, colonial to me of like, why is this guy didn't want to be king? This guy stopped being king. Like, why is this? Make Abu the king and then have him fly off or whatever. I don't. It just felt weird. It felt weird.
I don't know if Abu would have wanted that either.
I know, and that would have been funnier as it was. Of like, yeah. Throws the crown or whatever back to him.
That's true.
That could have been good. That could have been good.
Enjoy it. But it really was just Aladdin.
Yeah, it was like at one point.
And
the
horrifyingly,
movie,
Abu is a monkey in the cartoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At one point in the film, John Justin is wearing the exact, like almost exact costume that Aladdin wears in the animated film, and I was like, okay, now.
Yes.
Yeah. Jafar, the father character, is just
That was one of the more punchable sultans in cinema, I think. I was like, this guy is creepy and weird. He's a good dad, though. He's like, you don't have to marry this creepy old wizard if you don't want to.
Yeah.
Neglectful father.
I mean, at some point, I was kind of like, why not, man? This guy can, like, control the weather and shit. Like, it's pretty cool.
This will be good for you. It's good for the economy to have a wizard at the helm.
Yeah, right. But yeah, I mean, just sort of like a long history of Disney stealing other stuff.
Like, what? I spent a lot of time thinking about the Disney stuff afterwards, especially like in light of Steamboat Willie entering public domain and the already avalanche of stupid shit featuring Mickey Mouse that's being like just blasted out into the ether. Winnie the Pooh had this exact same problem last year or the year before. I just
don't look at the ether. Just do what I do. Don't look at the ether.
Don't look deep into it.
Yeah.
But I just wonder how all that happened. Like, did they buy the rights to this film? Is there nobody left alive to care about some of these? Or is this like perfectly legal borrowing of material and inspiration? I guess it's not egregious, you know, it pays homage.
Disney does what Disney wants to do.
Well, I mean, it's like, this is very much like, I mean, Arabian Nights is what, from the 600s, 700s or whatever? I mean, this is all like, well, I mean, yeah, there's no copyrights on any of that
stuff.
True. It's like the movie Hercules. I mean, they're just taking Greek mythology. This is, in a sense, just, you know, Middle East mythology.
It was a good time. It was a good popcorn movie, or whatever people ate in the 40s.
It did eat popcorn.
At movies, popcorn. Peppercorns, maybe.
It was, I mean,
tree bark. It was tree bark.
And I'm not just trying to stir up anything. I promise I'm never trying to stir up anything. But it's like thinking about this movie and about how much intentionality I really respected and like came away just like, man, there were a lot of problems, but boy, they fucking tried. And a lot of people tried in a lot of different ways. And like thinking about that being my problem with Johnny Guitar. Of just like how little slapdash and sort of, you know, less than production it was. I don't know.
It's interesting. Yeah. It's actually interesting that you say that, Peter, because I also thought about Johnny Guitar, and I thought about how I'd said that, like, that kind of like in like using like all that kind of inventiveness wasn't really like available, or the idea of that inventiveness wasn't really available, and I was completely wrong. You heard it on the podcast. I was completely wrong. This movie has interesting shots. It uses a camera like very well, in addition to the special effects shots. Like, this is an interesting movie to look at, and
Johnny Guitar was not
especially. It was colorful. I love those Technicolor costumes, but absolutely not as interesting as this movie by like a mile, you know. And I love Johnny Guitar,
and I didn't have this movie as a reference either when we watched Johnny Guitar, and I'm delighted to have seen Thief of Baghdad, and I do feel like I will watch this again just to witness it. I think that there's a lot to witness within here, and I just love the imaginations that kind of brought this up, that brought it to life, and the sort of energy that seems overwhelmingly put together to make it move.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting movie, lots of fun. I could definitely see watching it again and just
But that being said, like, I don't have a lot of deeper thoughts into it. Like, I'm like, I would read a book about the making of it, because having a production like this in like 1939 or whenever they were going through, like, because I think it started in England, right? Yeah. Like, I would be fascinated about all of the different hurdles and things that go into it. But it definitely is a pretty shallow-ish movie.
It's an adventure film, you know. It's like,
yeah,
it's,
yeah, exactly.
It's a popcorn.
There's nothing wrong with that at all.
There's nothing wrong with that. But like, you know, you kind of feel pleasant about it, or you feel less pleasant about it, and. You know, there's not a lot for us to break down, really. This is why the best episodes are the ones where we all hate it, or half of us hate it. But yeah, I don't have much else to say about The Thief of Baghdad. It's super fun. Go check it out. It's shorter than I thought it was.
It's kind of like doing a trip to the cinematic museum, you know.
And a really entertaining one, at least for me, a very entertaining one. Yeah. Like it didn't, wasn't homework. There was, this was, I was prepared to sit and eat my vegetables. And this was not vegetables.
It's candy.
It's great. Mm-hmm.
Sour Patch Kids, perhaps.
Snow caps.
Well, that is that.
Angela, what's your movie theater candy?
Oh, I do combo, ooh, whereby I eat Skittles with,
ooh,
my popcorn.
I do peanut M&M's.
So I get the sweet and salty at the same time.
You're
but
peanut
I can't...
M&M's, wizard? Oh, yeah. No. Sorry.
Put hard candy in.
Oh, no. I can't eat popcorn anymore from the movies because I can't eat butter. So, but my local theater has gluten-free vegan pizza, and so I go for that. It's not cheap, but delicious.
Hell vegan pizza at the movies. I like that. I like that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to the movies tomorrow.
That's Portland for you.
I'll get vegan pizza.
Hey, we got that in Oakland.
We do not have that in New York City. I repeat, we do not at all have that.
That's surprising, huh?
It is not. That is very New York.
How dare you?
New York does not care if you can't digest wheat or dairy anymore.
No cheese? The fuck you mean no cheese?
Exactly.
I mean,
right?
my Nighthawk Theater, they've got some like fancy good. They've got some good salads. There's some good salads you can get there, but alternatives are limited.
Well, I think we've come to the end of our tale with the Thief of Baghdad. Should we roll? Are we ready to roll?
Yeah, I am.
This is so exciting.
If you all are.
So legends speak of a podcast where instead of a traditional 1 to 5 or 1 to 10 rating scale, 4 noble adventurers took inspiration from a role-playing game. And it was pretty much the only inspiration they took from that role-playing game. And so we here at Crit Club, we rate our films on a 1 to 20 scale in honor of the polyhedral D20, which is the most effective of dice, at least for Dungeons & Dragons. Angela, what do you think?
I'm going to give this a 16 for just being a wonderful piece of cinematic history and capturing the imaginations of people for, you know, almost 100 years, and for being a pioneer in cinematic special effects. It was super fun, and I wish I had seen it earlier, so I would have made my kids watch it when they were young and would have been, like, impressed by such things. It was a fun time. Recommend it. Might watch it again.
Peter, what did we think of Thief of Baghdad?
I'm floating between a 14 and a 15, and listeners, of course, you can follow along with our spreadsheet of what we've rated everything, and I'm thinking about how that the 14 and 15 makes the difference between my color coding, and 15 is the really nice color, and I think this movie is worth the really nice color, so I'm going to go with a 15. What a delightful thing. Like, it's probably more 14, but I feel like I will watch it again, and I'm just, like, really delighted to have seen it and to know it exists. Thank you for this one, Wizard.
Hey. I did nothing. Corey, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of the same place with it, too. I think I'm going to go ahead and say 14. I don't think it gets pushed into the sort of upper, what is it, quadrant or whatever of movies for me, but I think it deserves a 14.
Awesome.
Yeah. How about you, Wizard?
Wizard, what about you?
It's just been a pleasant-ass conversation. Yeah, I'm going to give it a 16. I'm up there with Angela. This is like a fun movie. I, you know, like I said earlier, like I had fun seeing not just Aladdin, but like every other like big spectacle film sort of present in this. There's like a little bit of The Thief of Baghdad and all of those exciting movies. And yeah, what a pleasant-ass watch.
I just opened up our spreadsheet and I was wrong. It is 16 where the color turns green, and I'm not going to give this movie a 16. I'm sticking with 15.
Angela, somehow we knew. Somehow we knew the color would be right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Nice color. Mm-hmm. Nice olive.
Well, I mean, that's it for us. That's the role. That's the adventure. That's the legend. We would love to hear from folks who listen to the show. You can reach out to us at CritClubCast. Amazing.
Podcast. @gmail.com.
Podcast@gmail.com. And we're on the threads, sort of, and we're on the Insta sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. But we're, sorry, life.
We're fun and charming, and we'd love to hear from you and talk movies or talk about anything else. Maybe just keep it to movies, just so we can, we'll just talk to you about movies. But that has been it, and I would love to know what we are watching next week, because that's how this thing keeps going.
It's an Angela pick, I believe.
Well, get ready, because we're not going too far from the 1940s. We're heading into 1954's The Barefoot Contessa,
Jeffrey's a film by...
Make your favorite.
You got me excited about this.
Barefoot Contessa meal with Ina Garten. Pretend you're cooking for Jeffrey and watch the movie The Barefoot Contessa. It's directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. It stars Humphrey Bogart and Ava Gardner. Humphrey Bogart plays a washed-up movie director who, while in Madrid, scouts the beautiful Spanish dancer Maria Vargas and resolves to make her a screen star. His plan succeeds and makes her the toast of Hollywood, but the earthy Maria longs for more. And so, you know, listeners, you know, if you're feeling at the top of your game, there's always room for more. So join us and watch The Barefoot Contessa and see what we all have to say on our next episode.
What leads you to want to pick this, Angela?
I like these older movies that we've been watching, mm-hmm. and I wanted something a little more female-centric. I was going to pick a female-centric Western movie, but I wasn't really feeling that now, because that was a couple weeks ago, and I logged into Criterion Channel, and this just popped up, and I was like, I don't know much about this, but I've heard the name before, and, you know, any opportunity to reference Ina Garner is a welcome opportunity, so here we are.
She worked so hard in that house. It's, my goodness.
Yeah, y'all are making these jokes and references, and I'm Googling it. I have no idea who any of these people are.
You have not?
Corey, no? Corey, I dare you to go and get a Barefoot Contessa cookbook and cook a meal for your family.
Cook a whole chicken.
And watch this
What
film.
A dare.
Cook a whole chicken. Make something lovely for your partner.
He works so hard. And, such a long drive from the city.
Let's see if I can
make a cocktail.
Let's see if I can
if
help.
You're into such things.
So 28 seasons. I've never heard of this.
I was obsessed. I really credit Food Network and my obsession with it from 2008 to 2012, like helping me learn to cook. And so I watched a lot of Barefoot Contessa. Corey, I think the joke is that it's her show. It's Ina Garten's show, but also she's like, what was she? She was part of like the EPA or something. She was like a government official. She was like has a
for like
esteemed
the Nixon's,
career.
Nixon
yeah.
administration or something. But, and her husband is like also in politics.
But the joke is that like her husband Jeffrey just kind of like comes in sometimes. Like he's just like this very, very, very behind the scenes man while the Contessa just like makes everything. I don't know. I long to be a woman's Jeffrey someday. That is my goal, to be a Jeffrey.
I made truffle ice cream for Jeffrey because he's coming from the World Economic Forum or something like that.
Yeah.
I want to be Jeffrey.
He's,
so badly.
He's just such a... He just seems like me. Just letting the superstar shine in her kitchen. Mm. Or not in her kitchen, but on her show. And I want to let a superstar shine.
Jeffrey better treat Ina so well.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, every day is a school day.
So we are.
What if they got a divorce? That would 2024 is when Ina and Jeffrey get a divorce.
Oh, God, oh, no.
Oh my God! Don't why are you putting that into the? Because
I live for
universe?
The drama, Angela.
Don't give it
That's
any
good
ideas.
Tea. That's
oh
good
my
tea.
God. I mean, it's bad enough Jason Momoa is divorced Lisa Bonet is finally finalized. Come on.
Her club became a celebrity culture podcast so fast.
Yep. Didn't even know what's happening. Well, do we have anything? Well, let's move. What do we got left?
We got Barefoot Contessa. We got the other Barefoot Contessa. And now we proceed to a little section of the show called What Else You Watching? I'm going to go in reverse order because I'm a madman. Corey, what else you watching?
Yeah, I got, other than the Disney binge, which we don't have to get into, just Beauty and the Beast is just like toxic masculinity as a fucking movie. Like, mm-hmm. and it's so gross. And like, little baby Beast gets his little feelies hurt, and it's up to this woman to fix him. It's a bullshit. Fucking movie. And the songs aren't even good. Like,
I will not stand it. Be Our Guest is a fucking banger.
There's like one or two. There's that, and then there's the no one, whatever is like Gaston. No one.
There she goes. Like, the girl is strange.
That's fine. But like the other songs in the movie aren't good. But I do want to talk about Beef. Has anybody watched Beef on Netflix?
I watched it.
I loved it.
It's good.
I absolutely loved it. It's this. I won't give too much away, but it's like this very darkly comedic like drama that of just this escalating beef between two people, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And I don't know. I really, really loved it. It looks like the writer or writer and director or like showrunner or whatever says that he has like two more seasons worth of like ideas for things to go.
And I hope they never do it.
I'm like, you did it. Like this is a perfect season. It ended great. It ended fantastically. Like I don't know.
For people who are unaware, it stars Ali Wong and Steven Yeun. And oh my, Steven Yeun is like one of the best actors of our complete generation. He is an insanely gifted actor. And both of them are excellent in this show.
Everybody does a great job. It's really clever. It's just, they just create this whole little world with this whole cast of characters. Like, I don't know. Whoever the Isaac guy, like, just cracks me up. The, like, I don't know. It's it's a really, really good show. Good for them. And then I also watch Saltburn.
Oh, I'd love to. I've got to set aside time to watch Saltburn because I know I've seen it twice. Love it.
Okay, should I be afraid of Saltburn?
It's trashy as hell. I thought
that it was going to be like way worse than it was.
I knew nothing about it going
on. I knew nothing about it. Yeah, except that I just heard like, ew, Saltburn. It's
I don't know. The font was like the same font from There Will Be Blood. And I'm like, is this There Will Be Blood for like posh British people? Is that something I even want?
No, it's just supposed to be like old English script writing in, you know, old books, handwritten script type
Angela,
stuff.
It's a more shocking Cruel Intentions or Dangerous Liaisons.
That's
with a queer shocking like I saw it on Thanksgiving. It was part of my Thanksgiving double feature, and I had a great time with it, and then like I knew nothing about it, and there were a lot of criticism. A lot of people really do not like this movie, and I like listened to a lot of their criticism, and I think they are all completely right. I think it is a deeply deeply flawed movie in so many ways, but also I loved watching it.
Yeah, and so my reaction of it is like I had a really good time watching it, and I like it a lot less the more I think about it.
Yeah, I'm still the same. Like it was all felt very like surfacey and trashy, and but I don't know. But it also showed me a few things I've never seen before, and I think that I have a respect for it for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah. Saltburn. Yeah.
Saltburn.
Everyone's thoughts on Saltburn are correct as far as I'm concerned.
Sure.
Also, I had a great time.
That's it for me.
Peter, what else are you watching?
Well, I'll go on. So I'll just do one here. I've got a big, long thing to talk about, but I'm not sure if I'm going to save that for another thing. It's Canadian as well, but I'll save it. But I watched this movie came out, and it kind of came and went, called Eileen, like November or December or something. And like I just remember seeing the trailer, and the trailer had like sort of a psychological thriller vibe with Anne Hathaway and Temasek McKenzie. And it's like 1940s, like dark of winter in Massachusetts, where Temasek McKenzie is like, you know, in the 20s and working in a boys' prison, and then like a blonde bombshell, like femme fatale Anne Hathaway, like comes and sort of like changes everything. I don't know. The trailer made it seem like a thing, and then I watched this movie and I was bowled over by this movie. It definitely is a noir. It definitely is its own psychosexual thriller. It definitely has fucking Anne Hathaway being incredible. She is an incredible actor. And Temasek McKenzie, I think, also is just fucking outrageous. And this movie is like a smaller story than you'd think, but it just kind of turns and goes places. And I think there's a competency and confidence with the filmmaking that is just really stunning. The cinematography, the lighting, a lot of the staging. I think also because my expectations were just kind of like non-existent, I was very much bowled over by Eileen.
But were there some Massachusetts accents?
Yeah. Lots.
Oh yeah.
It's southy. It's southy. Ooh. Like it's like redneck, or not redneck, but like
it
working
is,
class.
Massachusetts is fucking, there's a redneck aspect to Massachusetts that no one ever talks about.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that place is fucking spooky.
It's very much set in like very working class 1950s Massachusetts. I don't know. I just can't believe this movie kind of came and went without a lot of chatter about it. I was really very impressed. And I don't know if that's, if a psychosexual drama with Anne Hathaway and Thomas and McKenzie set in a 1915 boys' prison in working class Massachusetts, shot in a very noir way, appeals to anybody? Hell yeah, you're going to have a great time.
Awesome. Damn. Okay, Eileen. That was powerful. That was persuasive.
It's,
Angela?
Yeah, it's,
I actually want to see it.
It's also like not long. It's a very digestible, I don't know. I just fucking can't believe I haven't heard more about this movie. It was very good.
Angela, what else are you watching?
Oh boy, I like Peter, I have a long list because it's been a couple weeks.
I had one thing. Oh,
I know, yeah. But you have a bunch of stuff you're not mentioning. But if I'm gonna have to pick one thing,
do things.
I am obsessed with Poor Things. I saw it in the theater straight after Christmas, and I haven't loved a movie this much since Amélie. It is just a completely other world. It is like goth Barbie. Where like, you know, you've got Barbie, it's all like all the pretty girls and stuff. This is a Barbie for people who don't necessarily feel right in the world at all. And I don't want to talk too much about exactly what happens, because the joy of this movie is that I had never really seen anything like it and was delighted by the creation of this world. And I just ate it up. And at the end of the first time I saw this movie, I turned to my friend and I was like, I will never get to see this movie for the first time ever again. So I keep taking my friends to see this movie because I want to watch them watching this movie, because it is so goddamn entertaining and unexpected and hilarious. And getting to see Mark Ruffalo in a role that it's a breakout role for him, in my opinion.
He was great.
And he was, if you go for no other reason just to watch his performance, which he said in an interview he was absolutely terrified by because it was so outside of what he normally does, but he is entirely convincing and delicious.
And delicious.
Delicious as a cat. I'm like, put that in the bank for later. Just an amazing movie that isn't just kind of like titillating and celebrates everything that is delightful about life and a certain type of hedonism and just eating the fuck out of life.
That's a good way of putting it.
Oh, it's just so, if I can see this movie 5 times in the theaters, I will do it. My New Year's resolution is to see as many movies in the theater as possible, because I'm just reanimated about cinema just in general. So please go to the movie, go see this movie with someone you care about, or, if you just want to feel kind of happy about being alive again, go see this movie, and just be prepared. There are some kind of gross spots. So if you're a little squeamish about like body stuff, you might want to be a little careful of that. And ultimately it's probably one of the biggest feminist pieces of cinema I've ever seen. That absolutely empowered me, and I can't wait to see it again. My dream is to be able to program a cinema and have like a matinee double feature of Barbie and Poor Things.
It's fun.
I just think it's probably for me the best film of the last 15 years. So I can't wait for you all to see it and tell me what you think. Email me about this. Peter, you saw it.
I did see it. I really liked it. Not as much as you, but that's fine. But I really, really enjoyed it. Like, I don't have many criticisms about it at all. I want to personally call out just Emma Stone. This was, I've always liked her. I've never thought she was slight or untalented. But this was the movie where I was like, oh shit, she's next level. Like, Emma Stone is incredible. Like, there's something about her performance in this movie that is like physical, and I don't know, she brings so much to this character. I was just stunned by Emma Stone, and I think I just wanted to give my personal shout out that like this was the movie that like I never thought she was untalented, but oh my God, I've been missing just how talented she is.
Well, this movie has turned her now into an icon. This is an iconic cinematic performance that will be remembered for the ages. The last time I had seen a performance like this, aside from Audrey Tautou in Amélie, is also Pulp Fiction. There's a Pulp Fiction element to this in terms of cinema that I just have never experienced before. And the dance scenes in it convey, kind of reinforce that a little bit. There is yeah, dancing.
Yorgos Lanthimos, of course, that's dancing. Always dancing.
But I would disagree with you, actually, about the Emma Stone bit, because her acting in his previous film, The Favourite, I thought was pretty incredible and portended the potential of what the new heights that she has reached.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm saying missed it. I'm saying this was the movie that made me realize how much I'd missed. Yeah.
We're also in the middle of watching The Curse, me and Frida are. So, and she's really great in that. I don't know, Peter, have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Did you watch it, Angela?
I have not seen it. The topic is a little bit much for me at the moment, but
it's super cringe.
Oh, that's really? Right. Yeah, no, I will be watching that.
I will be watching Nathan Fielder do his thing.
It's painful to watch. It's really painful.
Yeah. I would expect nothing less.
Once upon a time, I dealt with some of the things happening in that show, so I was like, maybe I don't want to see that. Mm-hmm.
Wizard.
Yo.
What have you watched? What else are you watching?
You know, I feel bad because I have started 2024 with not very much in the tank. I was living in a yurt on a farm for what seems like a very long time on minimal internet, which is delightful, and had no desire to stare at a screen, I guess. Love movies.
Did you read anything?
I have been reading. I have been reading a fantastic book. Called The Indifferent Stars Above. It's great light wintertime reading about the tragedy of the Donner Party. nothing like living on farmland in the Canadian winter and reading about the Donner Party. It's how I unwind. It's a fascinating, sad story. At the center of which is some dude trying to make money out in California. As so many American tragedies often are. But it's an incredibly well-researched book. It's very moving. It follows the story from one particular survivor, who was like a young married woman at the time of the. It's a nonfiction book, but it follows mainly her story because there's enough record to tell a story, I guess. It's a great piece of history, or a terrible piece of history, or both, but it's a really well written book. It gives you a lot to think about and digest, let's say. Other than that, no, I'm afraid not too much. Oh, I have. I also want to recommend The Monsters Know What They're Doing by Keith Amon. We don't talk about D&D a lot. But The Monsters Know What They're Doing is a blog series that was published in a hardcover book. It is combat strategies for dungeon masters. It is super funny and well written by someone who has a lot of love for the hobby of role playing and kind of helps you get into the heads of various monsters, give them goals and ways to make interesting and exciting fights in Dungeons & Dragons, which is someone who DMs often, I feel like I could always do a little bit better at. So
well, that's
really,
awesome.
Monsters,
I'd read that.
Monsters know what they're doing. Great book. Excellent blog. Check it out.
I mean, I've also been playing Baldur's Gate 3 if we want more D&D. Yes.
I'm stuck in Char's gauntlet. There's two huge battles that have just kicked my asses.
It's where my first playthrough petered out. I was like, I'm not having as much fun in this section of the game. I've also started playing Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader, which is a computer isometric RPG from the folks who made the Pathfinder video games. Super fun. Warhammer 40K is the funniest ass universe. It's like super nonsense all the time.
I'm worried. I've like wanted to dip my toe into because the lore seems insane. Seems like Dune mixed with Gears of War.
There's so many cheeseburger books based on that universe that Chris used to
books,
read.
Like all, there's so much, so many books, so much lore. It's all insane. It's just a perfect excuse for everyone in the universe to try to kill each other. And the RPG is fantastic. like the game really rewards leaning into the Warhammer-ness of it all, the grimdark of it all, I guess. And, you know, combat's fun. The story hasn't really taken off for me yet, but I'm still early in the game and I'm really enjoying it. So check that out as well.
I love it.
I think we did it. I think we pile onto our magic carpet and we sail away. If you want to sail along with us... do they sail? Doesn't matter. If you want to sail with us, check us out, critclubpodcast@gmail.com. Check us out on Threads. Check us out on the things that you socialize on. Next week, we're watching what, Angela?
We're watching The Barefoot Contessa, the movie, not the cooking show.
And we had a great time talking about The Thief of Baghdad, and we will see everybody next week. Tune in. Check us out.
Bye.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for listening.
Bye.